The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The Association of Healthcare Journalists held its fall summit recently. The title of the event was Reporting on Violence as a Public Health Issue. The entire program was amazing, very powerful, and greatly informative. We're going to hear a bit from one of the panels. John Roman is a brilliant researcher and a senior fellow with the Economics, Justice, and Society Group at NORC, the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. He spoke on a panel entitled, Everything You Think You Know About Guns is Wrong, Myths, Facts, and Where to Find the Best Research and Data.
So I work at NORC at the University of Chicago. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit economic and social policy research organization. I've been there since 2016. Before that, I spent 19 years at the Urban Institute in D.C., working on the same kinds of crime and justice issues there. I spent 2017 and 2018 embedded in the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice in New York City as the science director, and I live in Philadelphia, so I think I've got a number of major cities covered. So I guess the way to introduce myself is to say in a room full of criminologists, I'm an economist. In a room full of economists, I'm a criminologist. I suppose the subheader for my talk is, where's the justice data? We just heard two presentations about shooting data and where you can find it and wonderful resources from the CDC. And we talked almost not at all about where there's criminal justice system data that you can use in your reporting. So let me talk a little bit about why that is and what's happening. So most of what I want to talk about, I've done other work in this area, but most of what I want to talk about is some research that we've done in partnership with the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, which is now Arnold Ventures. And we sort of approach this by saying, what can we do around research and evidence around shootings that's helpful in the partisan political environment that we live in? And we came to this conclusion that any reasoned debate on firearms in the U.S. must begin with a shared set of facts, and that data is probably the most nonpartisan mechanism to engage and create a fact-based dialogue. Data isn't perfect, it's not perfectly nonpolitical, but it is more nonpolitical and nonpartisan than anything else we're talking about. So we did this in two phases. We started by convening an expert panel at NORC and bringing in leading, not just academics, we had them, but also people who work in local government, all around the country to think about what the biggest issues were around creating a firearms data infrastructure in the U.S. and then sort of expanded on that by identifying the three priority areas that we think are the most tractable, that are most feasible, plausible, possible to move the data infrastructure forward. So the conclusion is not going to be busting any myths. The current firearms data infrastructure in the U.S. is probably too limited to provide much of a foundation for a coherent debate, but there are all kinds of opportunities. Okay, so let me talk about the three products that came out of the expert panel. I'm going to sort of breeze through these. I realize we're running behind. If you Google, I've got the links here. I assume these presentations will be made available to everybody later on, but if you were to Google State of the U.S. Firearms Data Infrastructure and NORC, this would pop up. And essentially what we did was cataloged everything that has been done at the federal, state, local, nonprofit, community-based organization level that has some data around firearms in it, and created a catalog of more than 40 databases that can help to inform questions about firearms ownership, usage, storage, shootings, victimization, prosecution, et cetera. So one myth is that there's no data. There's a lot of data. The problem with the data is that it is so disordered and so segmented that it isn't particularly useful. It's not comprehensive and cohesive. But there is data out there, and we've tried to organize it in ways that are helpful for people who are for journalists, researchers, and public to access. The second report was my favorite because it's super academic, so it's by far the least interesting to anybody in the room. But what we did was created this table, which I think is really important. So it's 30 seconds to say, top left cell here describes data that is available for the entire United States and describes the entire population. So population-level data across the United States. Comprehensive data for research and policymaking. Most of what we've talked about today, with the exception of the YRBS, falls into this cell. This is when we say there isn't any justice data. This is the cell we're talking about. But in fact, that's just one part of the puzzle, because there's also data about specific subpopulations that are a particular risk of violence and victimization. Women in a relationship, young people in a social network. These are pretty broad categories, right? We have almost no data about them. We have almost none of the data that exists at the national level, YRBS being an exception, is available at the state and county and city level, which is where the action is. And there's very little about specifically at-risk populations that's available at the sub-federal level. So even if we solve the problems we want to talk about today, there's whole other buckets of stuff that we still have to work on in the future. So I have job security. I'm sure that's comforting. That was a joke. Okay, note, save the jokes. Okay, now, what all of this culminated in is a blueprint for a U.S. firearms data infrastructure. And we had a set of 20 recommendations that are available. Again, if you Google blueprint for U.S. firearms data infrastructure in NORC, this will pop up. I just want to highlight a few of our recommendations here, and they're more available in the final report. Non-fatal gunshots, we've talked a lot about. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in a minute. We talked about the limits of the 2021 national crime statistics that were just released earlier this month with the new system, National Incident-Based Reporting System, NIBRS, which has been a huge step back from the old system, the summary reporting system in the Uniform Crime Report put out by the FBI. We've gone from more than 90% coverage to 62% coverage. We know less today than we've known at any point since 1960, when the SRS was created. We're moving backwards on this question. We think that we need an annual survey of firearms ownership, acquisition, and storage practices. This is, in research speak, this is the denominator in any equation. This is what we have to know in order to understand any proportion, any ratio, and we do not know this. We think that there's a need for a lot of integration within the federal government to communicate about firearms and public safety, because it's one thing for CDC and the Bureau of Justice Statistics to get together and collaborate on projects, and that kind of agency-level collaboration happens with those agencies all the time, and that's great. But if you want to get the Department of Labor and Health and Human Services and the Department of Education and the Department of Justice together to create a comprehensive integrated database about firearms, then that requires a level of coordination that our federal government just isn't set up to do at this point. And pushing for that kind of coordination is really going to be critical to having the federal government play a more proactive and productive role in reducing firearms deaths and injuries. So we issued these set of 20 recommendations, and then Arnold Ventures came back to us and said, hey, let's focus on the three highest priorities for the expert panel, and let's create a real roadmap to fixing these problems. So these are the non-fatal firearms injury database, improving the timeliness and dissemination of federal data and research, and leveraging the Evidence-Based Policymaking Act for states and counties and local governments. So just a word on each of those things. So the highest priority for the expert panel was creating and implementing a comprehensive non-fatal firearms injury database. Now, here's the biggest myth, right? And it's a myth that's not perpetuated particularly in the media so much as it is perpetuated among policymakers and researchers. And it is this, that there is something different about a firearm death than a firearm injury than a shoot and a miss. And in fact, the only thing that separates those three events is luck. It's chance. Jacob Blake was shot 7 times by a police officer, and he lived, and apparently he's regained the ability to walk again. Shot 7 times and he lived. What's the difference between being shot 7 times and dying? Luck, right? So the fact that we know a lot about firearms deaths actually, as if that is a different category than firearms injury, is incredibly misleading. We should think about all of these things together. So there is no data set that tells us about firearms injuries from the criminal justice system. We have great public health data that where the backbone is the emergency department and inpatient data, and we can learn a lot about that. The problem is that, you know, for one, physicians aren't trained to enter this data in the way that we'd like, because the way that they enter the data, I'll go way down the rabbit hole for you, show you the kinds of problems that we confront. So if you're an emergency room physician and you are treating a patient who has been shot and you pull down the menu to indicate how they came to be shot, on that same list, you can select upper thoracic or lower thoracic, or you can select unintentional, or you can accident, or you can select intentional. So as you might imagine, the number of intentional shootings is underreported and underrecorded. And the problem here isn't that there's some huge problem with the way this data is entered. The problem is that we are relying on our emergency room physicians to save the person's lives and be really good data scribes. And that's kind of madness, right? The police should be collecting that data and making it available, and they don't. Research and data are not released in a timely manner by the federal government on the justice system side. This is a problem because, of course, there are 18,000 local law enforcement agencies in the United States, and as we heard, they report data voluntarily. There's no consequence for noncompliance, and so the data that they produce can change in quality and comprehensiveness, as we've seen in the last 2 years as we moved from UCR, which had great reporting, to NIBRS, which has relatively poor reporting. The data, as you've probably discovered, researchers and journalists have discovered, is incredibly difficult to access, right? It's not in a single place. If you look at our state of firearms data, you'll see that it's across multiple agencies, multiple levels of government, inside and outside government, and accessing each database requires a separate entry into that data system and data portal, and there's no way to link it all together. And this cannot be completely fixed, but this can certainly be better. These systems can certainly be better aligned to make access to information more readily available. And then the final thing that I wanted to point out was that in beginning under the Obama administration and then passed by Congress and signed into law by President Trump was the Evidence-Based Policymaking Act of 2018, which does two really important things. It does many, many really important things, but two to highlight are that it calls upon every federal department to create and designate a statistical agency within that department that is required to manage the data created by that department, and it creates a chief data officer in each of those agencies. And it says that each of those departments and agencies must share their data with other federal departments and agencies, which is a 180-degree shift from the way it used to be. It used to be you had to have special reason to share data, and the default was not to share data. And now the default is to share data, and you must have a special reason not to share data. And boy, this is really something that the states and counties and local governments would really benefit from learning about and having some support from the federal government to help them implement, because, of course, they're the ones putting all the data into these systems, and if their data aren't integrated by the time it bubbles up to the federal government, it's never going to be integrated. So that's where the action has to be, not at the federal level, but locally and at the states. Okay. So I'm sure I'm about out of time. Okay, so let me just wrap up. Okay. So the CJ system is way behind. We need better policing data. We need to understand who the shooter, what's missing from the public health data is anything about the shooter, right? We don't know who they are. We don't really understand the nature of the dispute beyond a very high level. We don't know the context for the dispute. We don't know who their co-offenders were, if there were any, what kind of social networks they're a part of. We don't have links to other crime scenes. We don't have information that helps us understand where to focus policing resources or even how much those policing resources should have.
That was John Roman, senior fellow with the Economics, Justice, and Society Group at NORC at the University of Chicago, speaking at the Association of Healthcare Journalists Fall Summit on a panel entitled Everything You Know About Guns Is Wrong, Myths, Facts, and Where to Find the Best Research and Data. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The National Safer Supply Community of Practice is a knowledge exchange initiative in Canada led by the London, Ontario Intercommunity Health Centre in partnership with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs and the Alliance for Healthier Communities. Its goal is to scale up safer supply programs across Canada. They've held a number of fascinating and informative webinars, their most recent, entitled Building Capacity Among Prescribed Safer Supply Providers, was held October 27th. We're going to hear a bit of that on today's show. Presenting on this webinar were Corey Ranger, a harm reduction nurse educator with the BC Centre for Disease Control, and Laura Cartwright, a harm reduction consultant with the AVI Health and Community Services Safer Knowledge Translation and Exchange Project. First, let's hear about the Victoria SAFER initiative. SAFER, S-A-F-E-R, stands for Safer Alternatives for Emergency Response.
AVI Health and Community Services started working with Prescribed Safer Supply before we even had a project. The day that BC's risk mitigation guidance documents came in March of 2020, a group of staff started to make phone calls and do individual advocacy with prescribers, trying on a one-to-one basis to get people to access a safe supply. And encountering all of the many barriers that we eventually learned about that comes with a medicalized safe supply, particularly the problematic risk mitigation guidance from BC. But in July of 2020, AVI Health and Community Services received federal funding to develop, implement, and evaluate a flexible model for the provision of pharmaceutical alternatives to the toxic drug supply. We were given around 10 months to develop this model, and we're doing it exclusively through outreach at the time. And so we started using the existing risk mitigation guidance documents in order to just connect with people who are in encampments and try to do needs assessment and try to advocate with prescribers. And then we developed our own team, and we eventually opened a clinic where we were able to offer fentanyl-based safe supply options. But we also concurrently did some engagement and evaluation and partnered with the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research to ask people what they really needed from a safe supply program. Victoria SAFER is intended to be a flexible model for prescribed safer supply. And if you look at this far right column in this very overwhelming and government-y table, you'll see that flexible options are intended to be low barrier. They're intended to be harm reduction and public health informed. And they're intended to uplift the priorities and goals of people who are accessing the program. Moreover, they're not intended to be treatment. They're not intended to force abstinence or coerce people to stop using, but more so to mitigate the harms of the unregulated drug supply. Those of us who work in flexible models, even though we know that we're categorized as flexible, we know that we remain quite high barrier to many people who try to access these services. So we did a little bit of engagement and consultation, as I said, and we asked around 63 people the central question, which was, safe supply would work for me if, and Laura will go through some of the results of that engagement session.
Yes, I will. People asked for many things. They asked for the right dose and the right drugs for them. They wanted a safe supply that was decriminalized and legal. They asked for safe supply and services that were accessible. Their prescription should not be limited to 7 days. They asked that they could easily access their safe supply. I want to be trusted with my prescription. They wanted safe, positive, welcoming spaces. I want a space free of stigma where people believe what I say. People want to be treated with respect. People know me at my space and they understand me. They wanted drugs that would help them improve their quality of life and help them to function. Drugs that help me feel normal and allow me to live my life.
Now we know that these services exist on a continuum, and that continuum has yet to be fully realized. And that's in large part due to government inaction, due to legislative and regulatory barriers. But essentially, Victoria SAFER, like many other SAFER programs, exists within this column of harm reduction prescribed SAFER supply. What that often means is that you're reducing the harms of your own system. You acknowledge that there's many barriers for people to access the your program? And what can you do in the here and now in order to mitigate those harms, reduce those barriers, and promote accessibility? We do this work knowing that we need to realize the rest of this continuum. And so part of our work is also taking the learnings of doing this type of work so that we can then feed that back to government and tell them exactly why a prescribed safer supply is not going to meet the needs of the many people who are at risk of opioid poisoning.
That was Corey Ranger and Laura Cartwright with the AVI Health and Community Services Safer Knowledge Translation and Exchange Project. They're speaking on a National Safer Supply Community of Practice webinar entitled Building Capacity Among Prescribed Safer Supply Providers, which was held October 27th. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's hear now some discussion about the medicalization of safe supply efforts.
So we know about the benefits, but maybe let's talk a little bit about the potential barriers and harms associated with a medicalized safe supply. Now, what we know for sure is that these programs are limited in what their reach can be, and a lot of that has to do with capacity. It's also because we as safe supply providers or operators are not responsible for the social determinants of health. And sometimes the biggest issues that participants experience when accessing a safe supply is that they're homeless or that they're experiencing poverty. And oftentimes people can't engage when they're experiencing a huge amount of social oppression and systematic oppression. We also know that most safe supply programs are being delivered through an addiction medicine lens. And with that comes egos, paternalism, territorialism, and oftentimes participants report not feeling trusted or believed by their provider.
Yeah,
there
Corey.
Sorry.
I just wanted to say that I think that sometimes doctors have a hard time with people who use drugs. Sometimes they might, I think, feel that if they relate or empathize too much, it'll make them complicit in a criminal underworld. If a doctor allows a patient-led care, they might feel like they're subverting their jobs.
We also know, thanks, that's a great point. We also know that there's a whole bunch of other barriers that are implied with prescribed and medicalized safe supply, and that includes rigidity and requiring urine drug screens. We also know that there is a ton of capacity issues that come with pilot programs. Like a lot of times organizations are afraid to operationalize these programs because they're being funded in a very precarious and unsustainable manner. And people don't want to start someone on an intervention knowing that they're going to have to pull the rug out from underneath them. And so a lot of these issues are so much bigger than the individual organizations or the programs, but they just speak sometimes to the impracticality of medicalized programs. Another reason why these programs struggle sometimes is because they are being delivered through an addiction medicine lens, which means they're being prescribed as a withdrawal management tool. Just like BC's initial risk mitigation guidance prescribing, RMG was actually brought out as a withdrawal management tool. What the government determined, or what the makers of this initiative determined, was that people were going to get sick. They were going to get COVID and they were going to need to isolate. And when they were isolating, they wouldn't be able to access their drugs. And so they would go through withdrawal. And so their prescribing protocols were targeted around eliminating withdrawal or reducing the harms of withdrawal. And that fails to acknowledge the many reasons why and how people use drugs. And so we put together this little graphic here, and this was done in partnership with Substance, Vancouver Island Drug Checkers. And it compares the morphine equivalency of 12 tablets of Dilaudid 8 milligrams to 5 points of down from the unregulated supply. And so if you are prescribed Dilaudid 8 milligrams, 12 tablets, you are prescribed the morphine equivalency of 384 milligrams. If you are taking or using 5 points of down, so half a gram of down from the unregulated supply at an average concentration of 3.9 to 14.8% of fentanyl, which is what they're seeing in drug checking, that is the morphine equivalence around 1,950 milligrams to 7,400 milligrams. You can see right there that we are not providing adequate dosing. Then you combine the fact that those options aren't smokable. And then you add the fact that all of the dope has benzos in it now. And so and on top of that 1,950 to 7,400 milligrams, we also have the synergistic effect of non-opioid sedatives, which are really complicating factors for people who are basic. We're basically being outpaced by the unregulated supply because we're not able to provide what people need. So how do we work within prescribed safer supply programs, acknowledge these barriers exist, acknowledge that these power dynamics exist, and still do good work? Well, oftentimes we're reducing the harms of our own program. Prescribed safer supply exists on a continuum which hasn't been realized, and we have to push for improved access, pharmaceutical options, and overall participant experience. We do this by reducing the harms of our own system, individual advocacy. We do this by supporting people and knocking down barriers to accessibility. If it's drug coverage and you don't have an ID, you don't have a birth certificate, how do we address that? If it's housing instability, how do we try and get you access to housing? If it's transportation and mobility, how are we going to get you into the clinic or into the program? That's the wonderful work of folks like Laura and the systems navigators and the support workers who work at Victoria Safer and work in these other projects, is that their entire job is eliminating psychosocial barriers and trying to provide that comprehensive support, because it's so much more than the drugs. There are opportunities in every corner of your protocol, every interaction, where you can try to reduce the harms. And sometimes it leaves a little bit of moral residue, because you know that you should be doing something different. You know that your program should be able to do more, offer more, be more accessible. And oftentimes you're working on an exceptionalist basis, even just for one person. But done right, we can contribute to the rise of non-medical models by highlighting the barriers that are erected through medicalized models.
So we've learned a lot in these challenging, unprecedented times. And while we've made progress, we've also made some mistakes. Here's what we learned from both. We're being outpaced by the unregulated supply. Measures for success need to include self-reporting benefits. People who use drugs are the experts of their own experience and relationships with drugs. Service models are flexible. That are flexible and led with people with lived experience are integral. The provision of pharmaceutical alternatives through an addiction medicine lens is limiting in reach and impact. People who use drugs take care of each other. When drugs are shared, sold, or exchanged, it is often about community care. Prescribed safer supply should be coupled with equitable access and safe resources and resources. Participants engage better when working with other people who use drugs. And the secret ingredient, again, is options.
That was Corey Ranger, a harm reduction nurse educator with the BC Centre for Disease Control, and Laura Cartwright, a harm reduction consultant with AVI Health and Community Services Safer Knowledge Translation and Exchange Project. They were presenting on a National Safer Supply Community of Practice webinar entitled Building Capacity Among Prescribed Safer Supply Providers, which was held October 27th. The National Safer Supply Community of Practice has a lot of really great material on their website, and more is always being added. Check them out at nss-aps.ca. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.